It's a great comfort to us as we imagine the green pastures and the still waters. And it also recalls the dark valleys as well, right? Calls us into the not-so-easy practice of sitting down at table with our enemies. That can be a challenge. And an unhurried God is present to us in the good times and in the difficult times, and invites us to be radically present to each other in the same way. So let's look at it, at some of the ways of being present, and ask ourselves, have we been too busy to be really present to one another? Now, there's a favorite story of hospitality in the Bible. It comes in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Scriptures, and it's one that can help us think through biblical hospitality. King David had just taken the throne, and he was having a banquet. And in those days, the practice was that if you're the new king, you get rid of everybody in the old king's family so that there's no competition, there's no possibility of somebody betraying you. So that the new king, David, he's asked that any member of King Saul's family come or be brought to the banquet. You can imagine what's going through their mind, yes? But David didn't kill them as they expected. He did this crazy thing. He asked for any remaining family of King Saul so that he could lavish God's kindness on them. He asked to show God's kindness to them because of Jonathan, who was King Saul's son and David's best friend, and of Jonathan's kindness to David while Jonathan was alive. And so what happened was, one of the men was a crippled man by the name of Mephibosheth. I worked on that all week. Mephibosheth. That's a lot. But he was brought into the presence of the king, of David. And I'm sure, you know, he was probably thinking, okay, how many minutes do I have left on this planet? And instead, David did something foreign to him. He asked Mephibosheth, Jonathan's son, who was a crippled relative of the former king, to sit at his table at the king's table. And not only just on that day, but every day for the rest of his reign, of David's reign. Mephibosheth and all of his relatives would never fear, but they would rather be provided for. Now, I just love how David provides for these remaining members of King Saul's family, potential enemies. He didn't just provide for their basic necessities. He didn't make them servants and give them just bread and water. No, the Bible says that Mephibosheth ate at the king's table as one of the king's sons. He was invited into a place of honor and lavishness. He was provided for in abundance. And there's one other element that to look at there. That Mephibosheth, he was crippled in both feet, we're told. He's unable to do anything for himself. This was before wheelchairs, before the American Disabilities Act. I mean, you were at the mercy of somebody who helped you. But he wasn't in any position to ruin David's kingdom. He wasn't going to attack him. He wasn't even able to come to the table by himself. But David, the man after God's own lavish, hospitable heart, he sought out this lame relative, this disabled relative of a former king, sat him down at a place of honor at the palace. He lavished goodness on one who, in the eyes of that society, had no worth and no ability. Another author tells this story also about a table story. He said, a few months before we were married, my wife and I purchased our first piece of furniture, a well-worn, antique English pub table. We paid more for it than we could afford at the time, but it just had the right combination of refinement and scruff to suit our sense of taste and to fit nicely into our small apartment. More than a decade later, when the time came to replace that table, that pub table, with something that fit, that better suited our growing family, we realized we could not get rid of that table. After countless meals together, often shared with family and friends, that table had become an icon of God's grace and goodness. To take up a place at that table was to occupy sacred space. The people we loved most had sat there with us. Meals were shared. Stories were told. Sins were confessed. We laughed together. We cried together. Together we remembered where we'd been and we dreamed of where we might one day go. We prayed at that table and there we experienced God's nearness, God's kindness, and God's love. Sharing tables is one of the most uniquely human things that we do. You know, no other creatures consume their food at a table. And sharing tables with other people reminds us that there's more to food than fuel. We don't only eat for sustenance. Tables are one of the most important places of human connection. We're often most fully alive, I think, to life when sharing a meal around a table. We shouldn't be surprised then to find that throughout the Bible, God has a way of showing up at tables. In fact, it's worth noting that at the center of the spiritual lives of God's people, in both the Hebrew Scriptures and the Christian Scriptures, we find a table. The table of Passover and the table of communion. A New Testament scholar, N.T. Wright, he captured something of this sentiment when he wrote, "When Jesus himself wanted to explain to his disciples what his forthcoming death was all about, he didn't give them a theory, he gave them a meal." I think that one of the most important spiritual disciplines for us to recover in this kind of world in which we live today is the discipline of table fellowship. In the fast-paced and tech-saturated, attention deficit disordered culture in which we live, Christians and all people need to recover the art of a slow meal around a table with people that we care about. Even maybe with those whom we are uncomfortable with. Table fellowship, see, it doesn't often make the list of the classical spiritual disciplines, does it? But in the midst of the world that increasingly seems to have lost its way with regard to not only food but the soul, Christian spirituality has something important to say to us about the way that sharing tables nourishes us both physically and spiritually. We need a recovery of the spiritual significance of what we eat and where we eat and with whom we eat. The significance of preparing a table. And a table fellowship is a spiritual discipline that's vital for shaping and sustaining our life with God for the world. That we need to make a point to share our tables with people who are in our lives but perhaps distant from God. And that was one of the most, you know, we think about it, that was one of the most distinctive practices of Jesus' ministry, sharing the table with people who may have been distant from God, from that sense, that reality of life. In her book, Making Room, Recovering Hospitality as a Christian Tradition, the theologian Christine Pohl, she observes, a shared meal is the activity most closely tied to the reality of God's kingdom, just as it is the most basic expression of hospitality. So, why is hanging out with friends so helpful? Well, because our face-to-face relationships are quite literally a matter of life and death. It's true. Human beings, we are biologically engineered for human interaction, and particularly face-to-face interaction. We are the most social of all the animals, says Professor Paul Gilbert, a psychologist and the founder of compassion-focused therapy. He said, our brains and our bodies are built to be regulated through interactions with others from the day that we are born. This is not the case with many other creatures, such as turtles and fish, that procreate in vast numbers. They don't need looking after, says Gilbert. Many of them will die before they reach reproductive age. The caring behavior associated with mammals is a major evolutionary adaptation. It changes the brain and the physiology of the body so that a parent is interested in staying in close contact with an infant. Think about it. That's a huge piece. One of the most important things is the human capacity for soothing and engaging. And so when a mother smiles at a baby, and makes eye contact, and that positive emotion in the face and the voice of the mother is stimulating positivity in the child. You can see why it's called mirroring. Yeah, the baby smiles back. And then the mother smiles back. It's that interchange is built into our human body and physiology. The ability to stimulate positive emotions, which is linked to happiness, this is Gilbert again, begins in interactions with others who are having positive emotions about you. So when we see our friends and they say, it's good to see you, it's important. It's more than just a trite kind of social greeting. There's actually something physiologically that goes on. So do it. It's okay. I know I feel guilty. What do you say to people? You always say, well, how are you doing, right? Or it's good to see you. It actually plays a role. Plays in a role in our being human. So when we, you know, when we're around others, it has this effect on our body. It's a physical thing, not just psychological. Gilbert even he says that the parasympathetic nervous system, right, as the known as the rest and digest system, as opposed to the fight and flight system, the parasympathetic nervous system is stimulated through the verbal and voice tone of relations with each other. As far as we know, he says, it's not that much stimulated through texts or other so-called social media. So there's a real reason why there's some argument about that. Generally speaking, we're designed to respond to voice tone and expression and stroking. We are physiologically designed for face-to-face interaction. Spending time together is social nourishment. So instead of texting a friend or messaging them on social media, why not just knock on their door, look them in the face, and you'll both feel better. There's a Danish and a Norwegian word which I learned about last summer when I was in Norway that speaks to this topic of preparing a table of social nourishment. And the word is hygge. And there's lots of different ways to pronounce it. H-Y-G-G-E, hygge, hygge. And it translates as a feeling of coziness. And it can also mean kinship, conviviality. You know, and if mindfulness is about ourself and looking inward, hygge is about sociable, being sociable and looking outward. It's about taking pleasure in the simple things of life. And taking, it's about fellowship, fellowship with kin and kith. And underpinning hygge, it's a craving for simplicity, an urge to pare back on everything, back to the basics. It's about jettisoning the anxieties and the clutter of our modern life and living to free up time and energy to make the most of life. At the core of hygge is the guiding principle that we must all make the most of the short time that we have here, and to be kind to ourselves and to be kind to others. As we imagine the green pastures and the still waters of Psalm 23, as well as the dark valleys and the not-so-easy practice of sitting down at table with our enemies, let's remember that an unhurried God is present with us in both the good and the difficult times, and that God invites us to be radically present to each other in the same way. And there are some practices that we can take up, that we can make a part of our daily lives that which can help us to reconnect to God and to each other. Amen.